C1T. Number 5B.
This brings us to soul a soul. It is asking us to rebuke egotism. Can you see? Yeah, notice that before the moment we come to soul, it is as if she always would say, now, first clean up your own house. Start at home, so to say. Don't start always with the other fellow. We know that everything is consciousness, and therefore everything happens within our consciousness. Therefore, start cleaning out your false ego out of your consciousness by rebuking egotism. The marginal side note there is egotistic darkness. It's always when the egotistic sense comes in, it always darkens everything. The moment everything concentrates on one's own personality, of one's own ego, one loses naturally the vision. That's quite clear. We don't see anymore the straight line of spirit, we don't see anymore the aim, we don't see anymore our purpose and our aim, where we are going, where the treasures really are. And so start at home. I always like to think that if I get into trouble, I always think, well, that's my business. I got into trouble. If my consciousness is pure, then I wouldn't get into trouble. I like to start with myself and not always think that it has something to do with somebody else. If we live and move and have our being in God, we certainly would be free. So that's also what she says here. We shouldn't have the luxury of learning with egotism and vice. And when we outgrow the old, the egotistic sense, and we outgrow the old, you should not fear to put on the new. Something very interesting. Where she says, your advancing course may provoke envy. The moment one gets free of one's own self more and more and begins to advance spiritually, it always somehow provokes spiritual envy. But there it's nice to remember what Mrs. Ellie gives us as a consolation, but it will also attract respect. And I always like to think of this. Withhold not rebuking error and never breathe an immortal atmosphere unless it is the attempt to purify it. So here we have that short paragraph on soul, a soul, which really says, get out of your own ego, get rid of your own ego. It's a long journey to go from sense to soul. We know that. That's not the job of a day. It's not the job of a year. It's usually a lifetime job to get more and more away from one's own ego and see that we win everything if we put everything back into soul. She leads thought on to principle and shows that acting rightly makes wrong practice impossible. Can you see now how we make malpracticing impossible? Where it frees us from malpracticing. It's naturally a big subject, that whole question of malpractice. We always think, well, it's the other fellow that malpractices us. We would never dream that we would malpractice something, that we would fall into the trap of malpracticing. But naturally, she has shown that we do that ignorantly, that we are not aware of. Therefore, it's a quite tricky thing to see what can I do that I do not unconsciously, unwillingly, unawaringly malpractice either me or somebody else. Usually one malpractices oneself. That's usually the biggest target and the most common target, that one malpractices oneself and not so much the other fellow. We usually have not enough time to malpractice the other fellow, but we have plenty of time to run us down, to run ourselves down and malpractice on us. So Mrs. Eddy must give us here a divine method, a clue, so to say, how we can free ourselves from this ignorant, mistaken malpractice, and says the best way is if you practice rightly, if you are consciously aware of what you should do. Therefore, the whole tone here in principle is again about acting rightly. The marginal heading here is unwarranted expectations. It means that we usually have expectations that are unwarranted, that somehow people live in a world of fantasy and expect things to happen which are actually not embedded in being, but which we humanly build up, and then we are dissatisfied if it doesn't happen, if we are disappointed in our expectations. So she speaks about this disappointment, that disappointment of our expectation, and we will be disappointed when? She gives some reason. Says we'll be disappointed when we simply think that by repeating the author's words that we will be able to demonstrate anything. That by right talking and wrong acting, we will also be disappointed. Such a practice, she says, does not demonstrate the science of mind healing. Can you hear the whole tone of principle, the demonstration of principle through right action? So, therefore, she brings in the true sense. The right is radical, she says. Therefore, the teacher must know the truth first himself. He must live it and love it and wash himself clean from conservatism. So when the spiritual sense of truth and false, its harmonies, you see, it's terrific. When she has depicted really always the human fallacies, which is only possible on the human level and therefore depicts really the human aspect, the human characteristics of that level, and shows how this doesn't lead anywhere, then she always lifts it right up on a higher level and says, you know, the answer is in the divine ethics, in the ethics of Christian Science. When the spiritual sense of truth unfolds its harmonies, there we should start and see what truth unfolds. Those are the harmonies. Those are the reliable harmonies. There we will not be disappointed, because truth always works according to principle, and that is harmonious. Then, she says, then we take no risk in the policy of error. Then the policy of error, all that calculating of error, just will not touch us and will fall flat. Then he goes further to life. What do we see here at the tone of life? He says, practicing rightly, which even destroys the inclination to practice wrongly. Can you see the further depth here, which he says, it isn't so much a question that you practice wrongly and therefore you should practice rightly, but she even goes further and says, but from where really should you get the inclination to practice wrongly? I mean, she begins to see that what Paul has seen, that it is actually not the sinner that sins, but that it is actually sin that sins the sinner, that sin makes him inclined to practice wrongly. And so she has to tackle that whole question here too, and that's at the point of life, where we really feel that here, that if we practice rightly, that even the inclination to practice wrongly would disappear. You know, that reminds me right now of that statement which we considered about Bertrand Russell. He said the very same thing there, didn't he? When we read that passage where he said that if we would have that standard of value, that it would make us do in an irresistible way the right thing, so that we would not even have an inclination to do the wrong thing. And that naturally would be science. That it is not constantly the moralist within us that constantly has to struggle, do I now do the right, don't I do the right, how can I do that I don't do the wrong? But that there is such a natural flow within us that says you will not even have an inclination to do something wrong. That we would, in an irresistible way, do the right thing without trying to be good through a mere moral codex. And you see, this is adapted to this very point here. And again, Mrs. Eddy has a juxtaposition in this part where she compares acting from a sinful motive with the acting from a Christian Science standpoint. She says, if we act from a sinful motive, that destroys your power of healing from the right motive. But on the other hand, if we adopt Christian Science, so she goes right again on the higher level of science, then the inclination or power to practice wrongly would be destroyed. Can you see? We should arrive at that point where we are so at ease with the truth of being. So at ease with the flow of being, of life, that only the right action flows through our consciousness, that only the right motions flow through our consciousness, that only right motives speak up in our consciousness, so that it isn't a struggle to do the right thing, but that we are just taken by truth to do the right thing. And this is what we really should attain, but let's attain it through a scientific way and not through a moral effort. Because a moral effort in the long run will just not do it. We have to become scientists in this chapter, and so let's do that in that way. Just lifting up our consciousness constantly above sin, evil, error, whatever it is, above the human level of things, and start out from the powerful potency of truth, and see that that can destroy our inclination or even the power to practice wrongly. Then, if that is destroyed naturally, then it's quite reasonable to see the next subtone of truth, which says that right practice is invincible. Nothing can be victorious against right practice. And we get again the tone of truth as the victory of truth. We had that before, in especially in Minder's Truth, we had the victory there. Here again, we see that right practice is invincible. The marginal heading is winning the field. You have again the victory. So it says, victory rests on the side of invincible truth. So before, at the point of life, she has said, go to life and let that, go to truth and let that truth flow through your consciousness, then that will practice you. All right, if it practices you, then we come to the next subtone, that is an invincible truth, that the strife between right and wrong, truth and error is over, that the even if there is a mental chemicalization following that explanation of truth, don't mind it. That's a good thing. That's a sign of God. That's the love of God behind it, which wants to overturn and overturn and overturn until it comes whose right it is, so that the higher basis is won. You see, it's so beautiful to face honestly error, to face honestly what is called sin. Face honestly sin. What? Sin not to be in line with God. That's sin. It has nothing to do with a moral issue. Not to be in line with that line, that straight line of spirit. It's always so wonderful because it always brings us higher. It never leaves us there where it met us. It's that same story as in the Noah story, that the ark rested on a higher plane when finally the flood was over, and so he has gained something through that experience. So always when we are, as she says here, in a mental chemicalization and because of the impact of truth, a higher basis will be won. And so we have to live by the promise, really, with the bow of promise, that something terrific, new, and beautiful, and better, and higher will come out of that very situation. Yes, that's the tone of the victory of truth, which leads us further to the subtone of love. Sin must be uncovered for the sole purpose of blessing others, never for the purpose of running down somebody, of cornering somebody, of defying somebody. Always motivated by the tone to love somebody, to love others. Because it talks about ministering to human needs. You must know yourself first. You must know yourself first. That's the most difficult thing. To have a good perspective on oneself. One usually has a better perspective on the other one. But to know oneself first is not always so easy. Honesty, which means knowing oneself first, is honesty, is spiritual power. It's a terrific statement that honesty is spiritual power and wins divine help. It just shows that we never lose anything by facing an issue. You see, the argument of animal magnetism is always, especially of ignorant animal magnetism, is always that if we face an issue, we may lose something. And divine science always comes in and says, no, that's the very opposite. The very opposite is that you will win a lot. You win divine help, and therefore a right motive, she says, has always its reward. It will always bring to us something which is higher and better than ever before. And so, she finishes up that whole tone of soul. Yes. That was a short one. Let's go through it again. As we have time, it's no use to start with another main subject so that we don't have to hurry through it. But again, we can sit down or sit back, perhaps, and say now, what have I learned? What have I learned really to see something about my true identity? That true identity which cannot be malpracticed, therefore which cannot be taken away from me, not be marred by anything else. What is my true identity which I cannot destroy, which I, through my ignorant malpractice, cannot destroy, cannot deface? What should I do to protect that? That's a great subject of soul, namely what we had here, strict adherence in rules of soul, is that which protects me from disidentifying myself from what I truly am. So we want to keep up our unchangeable identity, untouched by sin, untouched by evil, untouched by ignorance. What shall I do? So again we would see that we have to remember that man actually himself is never a sinner, that it is always sin that tries to sin the sinner. We have always an impersonal status of ourselves. We don't sin. We can't be sinned. Man is always the identity of God. And in order to uphold this untouchable identity, Mrs. Eddy would say, now teach yourself how to handle that through some rules. As mine, she says, first of all, open your eyes to that possibility of animal magnetism, either ignorant or malicious. Recognize that there is something at work in your mentality that could destroy yourself. Perceive really the nature of that kind of animal magnetism that can work through ignorance or through malice aforethought. So be awake, mind. Then you come to spirit, and she says, therefore, make a line of defense. Bar your thought against the influx of evil thoughts. How shall you do that? By understanding actually the unreality of evil, by arresting really wrong thoughts, so that they cannot unfold, that you don't nurture them, so that they cannot grow and grow in your thought and become bigger and bigger until it becomes a monster. Arrest it. At the point of soul, you have to do something more, she says, rebuke error. Rebuke the egotistic darkness and outgrow your egotistic standpoint without fear of the new. You will not lose anything if you outgrow it. You will win everything. The field will open up and open up, and something much more beautiful will show itself. Then she goes to principle and says, yes, but how can you do that? How can you rebuke error? You can't rebuke error just by rebuking. Say how bad it is. Do something positive about it. Principle says, act rightly. Because only acting rightly is of the nature of principle, therefore operates and operates. Wrong practice only disappoints, but right practice demonstrates the harmony of the divine principle. You should even see that the fullness of life is flooding your consciousness so, and you sustain that fullness of life, then in your consciousness there is not even an inclination to do the wrong thing, to go a wrong way, to really go along into a false direction, to have a false purpose, to have a false aim in view. It even destroys your inclination to do so. And at the point of truth, it says, and if you act rightly, this is invincible. Nothing can destroy that. Nothing can be more powerful than that. Don't fear. Go on. Don't fear. And at the point of love, he says, and acting rightly, you will get your reward. Acting rightly has its reward. It is always blessing men and never injures anybody. Can never hurt us. And that wins divine help. That's how she ends that subject. It's quite a powerful exposition of the rules of soul. Yes? All right. Tonight we take up the next tone of principle.